So there we go. That's what we're going to be doing over this term. So what lies behind all of this? Have we just kind of chosen some characters and let's read some Bible stories about some people? No. Basically, our starting point in all of this is that we would really like to focus in on some important principles about God, about what he's like, about his character, and how he interacts with us. We want to focus in on what we're like, what humanity is like, and the good, the bad, and the ugly of that. And as it said there, the characters that we're going to be looking at, we hail them as heroes in the pages of the Bible, heroes in terms of being followers of God. But you don't have to read very much to know that they weren't heroes all the time. They were ordinary men and women that we're going to be looking at. So we can learn from their lives, both in terms of the great stuff they did, but also we can learn from their lives in terms of the mistakes that they made. And we're going to be looking at creation, the world in which God has placed us, and looking at some principles to do with that. And we're going to be doing that through the focus of these different Bible characters. You know, it's amazing. I often think about this. The book that God has given us, this Bible, is that a Bible or is it? Yeah, that's fine. There we go. This metal case here that's just dropped the Bible out of it. There we go. Sometimes people, Christians, talk about the Bible as an instruction manual from God, and I kind of understand that. But, you know, it's not been written like that. It's not written like the instruction manual you get with your washing machine or whatever. And I know men tend not to read instruction manuals anyway, but it's not written like that. God could have given us this huge book. You know, you could have been reading this week that, you know, God created Adam and then said, look, here's the instruction manual, Adam. Just read through this from cover to cover. And, you know, when you've got to page 3,500,029, precept number whatever, you'll know everything you need to know about following me. But the Bible's not been written like that. The Bible is largely narrative, as you know. It's largely stories, stories about ordinary women and men. And that's so we can relate to this. And so that our walk with God isn't a kind of, well, you know, what instructions should I be following now? But we can absorb what Scripture teaches us and live it out in our lives, living our stories out, even as the characters we're going to be looking live their story out. So this week, by the way, sorry, one other thing. With these wonderful little booklets, you might have been thanked last week, but the lovely booklets you've got for the Bible reading and all the graphics, huge thanks to Rachel and Beth, was it, as well, who put all that together, raising our game with all of that, so fantastic to see. So the readings this week, if you've been doing them, you've been reading through the first couple of chapters of Genesis. That's what we're going to be focusing on this morning, and we're going to be looking at the first part of the story of Adam. And there are three words, really, that I want us to focus on. And conveniently, they all begin with the letter S. Sacred, sons, and stewards. There are some principles in what we've been reading this week, which we can kind of hang around those three words. And what we've read this week, I hope if you have been reading it, and I encourage you to do it, you've taken in some things which will shape our view of ourselves and shape our view of the world in which we're placed. Before we go on, let's just think a little bit about Genesis, because sometimes this all gets controversial and it really doesn't need to. But I'm not going to go into great detail this morning about things like six-day creation, except to mention that the word translated as day can be translated as meaning any length of time, by the way, and is translated to mean different lengths of time in different places in the Bible. But I'm not going to go into that. I'm not going to go in great detail about exactly where we place what we've read and what we're going to be reading over the next week in the great timeline of history. But there are two important principles that I do want to emphasize. The first is that Genesis teaches us right from the very beginning, and we're going to see this, truth truth about God, his creation, and in particular, within that creation, humanity. It's there to teach us truth. And there is amazing truth right from the very beginning of this book. And secondly, I just want to say that because of that, the when and the how, you can go into that if you like. I'm not going to this morning, because I believe that actually in terms of the intention of why it was written, how it was written, how it would have been seen by the ancient people who first received it, the when and how is much less important than the why. And this morning, can we focus in on the why of God, the why of us, and look at the truth of that. And just to illustrate that, perhaps we could just start with the very first words. So Genesis 1:1, the very beginning of the book. Now, any of you who are kind of into books, anyone belong to a book club at all? Yeah, a few people, that sort of thing. Or studied literature at school or a university or any of that stuff. You will know that the opening words of a novel, of any book probably, are incredibly important. They set a scene. They kind of, sometimes they sort of tease you a bit for what's going to be happening, but they also lay down some guidelines often for what you're going to be reading. I tried to write a book at least once, but once has got as far as actually sending a bit of a manuscript off, and it didn't get very far. But I do know that when you do that, one of the things publishers always want to see is show us your opening page, because from that they can tell what the direction of the book's going to be and whether you can write or not and stuff like that. So Pride and Prejudice, opening words. Absolutely right. Round of applause there. Tale of Two Cities. Best of Times. See, these things become famous because they're memorable, because they set a scene, because they plot a direction. And the Bible does the same thing. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. First of all, in the beginning. The Bible wants to make it very, very clear. God, in his word, wants to make it very, very clear that there was a beginning. And with the beginning is the sense of an intentionality. There was a beginning to all of this. There's not just an endless wheel of karma with no beginning and no end, as some belief systems would have you believe. There was a beginning, a definite beginning. There was an intentionality about this. And even though it's not particularly contained in these opening words, implied within that is with a beginning, therefore there is an end. There is a progression through history. There is a timeline that starts with these opening words. In the beginning, what? Well, in the beginning, God. In the beginning, God, before all other things. And that's important. Not in the beginning, some random act of nature. Not in the beginning, man. So often we place ourselves in the center of the universe. But we weren't there at the beginning. In the beginning, God. The Bible wants to say, yes, in terms of time in the beginning, but also in terms of preeminence. In the beginning, in all things, through all things, God. That's a fantastic reminder to have. When we're tempted to place ourselves at the center, or the culture and values and riches of the world in the first place, the Bible wants to say, right from its opening words, no, in the beginning, God, of first importance. What did God do? Well, what's he like? Well, in the beginning, God created. Right in his opening words, what's God like? Well, here's the first thing we know about God. He is creative. He's not static and immovable and removed. No, he is a creator. He is creative. It's in his nature. It's in his character. And he's intimately involved in all that we see. And whatever the mechanics of it were, the world did not come as the result of some random act, or the belief systems of the ancient people around the first people reading this, the world didn't come as the result of the fallout from a cosmic war between dueling gods. It wasn't an accident. No. In the beginning, God created a creative and deliberate act by an all-powerful God who brings order from chaos. So we then find something else about his character. He is one who brings order from chaos. That's what he does. It's what he's always done from the beginning of time, and that's what he can do today in the world and in our life. And what did he create? Well, he created the heavens and the earth. Now, there's two ways of looking at this. First of all, you could just say, okay, that just means he created everything that we see. And that's fine. But also, see, that word heavens or heaven, depending on what translation you're looking at, it can mean the skies and the ground. Or it can mean the spiritual realm. Heaven can be, even here it's translated in both ways in the Old Testament, it can mean the spiritual realm where God lives. So in other words, right from the start, we have a very clear statement in the Bible that God created both the material and the spiritual. And he was involved with both. And as we'll see later, he calls them both good. God isn't just concerned with spiritual things. We don't have a Bible that teaches us a dualistic view of life, where spiritual, whatever that means, is all that is good, and material is somehow inherently bad and less important. No, God created both, spiritual and material. He's concerned about both. This is not the dualism of Greek philosophy where material is inherently bad. No, we are supposed to be concerned with both because God created both. That's a lot of theology in one sentence, isn't it? But that's what Genesis is like. So Adam. Well, the first thing to note, and many of you I know will know this, that in your translations it will have the word Adam with a capital A as a name, and clearly it's intended as a name, but the word there literally means man or humanity. And I think we can read it in both ways. There is truth here, not just about one person. There is truth here which is to do with principles that apply to humanity, to all of us. And in thinking about the passages that we have read this week and then are going on to read next week, it just occurred to me that sometimes, bit of a generalization, I know, but sometimes I think, certainly as evangelicals, there can be a tendency just to flick back to Genesis, the beginning of Genesis, when we want to look at Genesis 3 and look at what went wrong. Now, I'm so pleased the way that the readings have fallen, where we get onto that next week, but we've also had a focus this week on what happened before things go wrong, which is really, really important. Really important. In terms of our understanding. So, today, this morning, can we focus, can I encourage you to focus on God's intention more than Adam's corruption? Does that make sense? We're going to look at what went wrong next week. But this morning, let's look at God's intention. And we will focus first of all on that word, sacred. Sacred, if you Google it, say, what does sacred mean? First thing that comes up is that it means something connected with God. Before we look at Adam, let's consider where he is placed. Eden, the garden, which from the start is pictured as a place where God meets with humanity and talks with them. Now, if you just allow me to go into chapter 3 just for a second, it specifically says in Genesis 3 verse 8 that God walked there. And that word can literally be translated as it's the place where God walked about. It's not, I don't read it, and theologians generally don't tend to read it as, you know, God's distanced and then something goes wrong, so he comes striding in for the first and only time. No. The garden was where God walked about and communed with man. It's the place where he is present. And creation is in that sense set up to be sacred. A place for us to meet with God. Now, to the first readers, to the Jewish mind, there's even more to it than that. And I haven't got time and I don't know enough about it anyway, but to go into great detail. But the way in which the garden is described, the way in which God presences himself there, the way in which the functions that Adam and Eve are meant to fulfill are described, the language that is used for the Jewish listener has a lot of resonance with the way in which the tabernacle and the temple are described and the imagery that's used with those places, which were seen as the place where the priest met with God and God met with man. When I first did my notes, I said that the garden mirrors what's said about the temple. And of course, that's entirely the wrong way around. It's what's said about the temple is mirrors what is said about the garden. It starts with a garden. And so just one quote. So it's a place of meeting with God. It's where God walks about. And here's one quote about that. A guy called G.K. Beale, The Temple and the Church's Mission. The cumulative effect of the parallels between the Garden of Genesis 2 and Israel's Tabernacle and Temple indicate that Eden was the first archetypal temple. Eden was the first temple in garden-like form. It was always intended to be a place where humanity met with God. That's how creation was set up. But it's not just the setting. Oh, that shouldn't be like that, so let's put that one in as well. It's humanity that are also connected with God. In Genesis 2:7, how did life, what makes life happen? The breath of God. We are God-breathed. And we are made, it says in Genesis 1, in the image and likeness of God. Your translation might just say in the likeness, or it might just say in the image, but there are two words there in the Hebrew, tselem, tselem and demut. One meaning image, one meaning likeness. Now, I'm not a Hebrew or an Aramaic scholar. You'll be amazed to know. But those who are will tell you that there is a particular importance in those two words being used. Other words could have been used, but those two words, actually in ancient culture, we have now archaeological evidence of how they were used, and they were used often like this. This is the statue of King Adad-iddi, who was an ancient Assyrian king. In fact, he's the guy, apparently, is the oldest Assyrian king that we've got evidence and stuff for, and that statue was in the Damascus Museum. I don't know if it still is. And in the Aramaic bit of inscription around the base of the statue, it says that this is in the image and likeness of King Adad-iddi. But also implied, you see, because the kings were seen as God's representative on earth, is that this was also the image and likeness of the God. And there is evidence of it being used in idols. What do we know about idols? Well, they were seen to be the representative of the God on earth and carry the God's power. This statue was meant to say, this is the place where this king rules and in some way represent him and represent his power. And we, ladies and gentlemen, are made in the image and likeness of God. We are placed here to be his representative, carrying his authority and power, and be like him. Selah, which as we know is used in the Psalms, and means stop and think about that one for a moment. The second point is very closely related. Sons. Now, let me just push the brake pedal just very gently at this point and say I've used that word sons because in the culture that the Bible is immersed in, sons have a particular different authority and power and inheritance and position to daughters. So I've used the word sons, and also it helpfully alliterates with the words sacred and stewards. However, in terms of our culture, and dare I say in terms of kingdom culture, I think we should probably say that. Sons and daughters. And if we are in the image and likeness of Father God, what does that mean? Well, it means that the intention was that we have the rights of children in terms of inheritance. It means that we are meant to exercise rule and authority, but not do that in any kind of dictatorial way, but to do that representing the God that we are like and representing his character. It also means that we have freedom and choice. And we read this right from the word go. Adam and Eve are not chained up in the garden. There are no bars on a cage. There's no sense in which they are pre-programmed to only behave in a certain way. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the film Stepford Wives. There was a remake probably 20 years ago now. And in the Stepford Wives, in the remake, there were this group of women that as soon as they moved into this area, suddenly they looked the same, they dressed the same, they had the same opinions, they were all slavishly obedient to their husbands, and I think it's Nicole Kidman playing the lead part. Yes, thank you for that confirmation. She is not prepared to go along with this, and she sets out to find out what's actually happening. And it turns out they are having a microchip implanted in their brain, which kind of programs them to behave in that way. And she asks the guy who's responsible for this, can they say, I love you? And he says, yes, certainly in 56 different languages. And she says, but do they mean it? Fantastically theological bit from that movie, which wasn't really that great. But in other words, unless we have freedom and choice, love means nothing. God didn't program us and put chains and bars around the garden, to use this imagery, in order that we would love him. He wanted us to love him and love each other and experience love from him from a place of freedom and choice, because only then does love make sense. Yeah? And so they're given guidance, but they're not programmed to follow it as puppets. And we see the results of that when we read next week as to what could go wrong. But it's important that it was there. sacred, sons, and finally, stewards. God looked over all that he had made and saw that it was very good. Not just good, but in that 1 verse 31, it was very good. When it was all done, it was very good. The heavens and the earth. So the Lord God, Genesis 2:15, placed the man in the garden to do what? To sit and meditate, to sit and pray, to sit and sing psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. Important though all those things are. No, man is placed in the garden to tend it and watch over it. Humanity not told to sit and contemplate purely abstract spiritual matters. No, we're here with a purpose of guarding and developing that creation, of taking God's rule and reign throughout all of creation as his representatives on earth, and doing that, showing his character, his love. What does that mean? Well, I've got a feeling, we're sons and daughters, that should say stewards. No dualism, as I keep on saying, where only prayer and contemplation have meaning and value. No. All of creation important, and we are supposed to care for it, because creation is a temple. Now, what does that mean? Well, I'll let you work that through as to what that means for you. But I believe it does mean the challenge is that we are those who should be leading the way in a care for God's creation, not seeing it as some second-rate endeavor just for slightly fringe groups. The people of God, we're put here to care for creation, because it's a place to meet with God, to experience his presence. It's a place that's meant to bless humanity, and we should treat it as such. You know, I doubt whether any of us would enter a traditional church building and throw down cans and leave litter and all of that stuff, but it's no more a place of meeting with God than creation was intended to be. And obviously there's more to it than that. So finally, Maddie and the rest of the band, I wonder if you'd like to come back up. So what? Just true of Adam or true of humanity? Male and female, he created them in the image of God. Both, by the way, needed to express the image of God. Perhaps you'd just like to close your eyes for a second and think about these questions. First of all, how does what we've heard this morning affect how you see yourself? What is your view of yourself? What is your image of yourself? Have you allowed life, others, to describe you as some kind of second-rate person, as someone who is less than adequate, as someone who will never make it, any of those things? Can you find fresh faith for who you are created to be? You were always intended to be created in the image of God. Yes, that image has got damaged in this world, but in Jesus, it can be fulfilled again. How do you see others? When we look at others, do we see God's fingerprints in them? Do we see his face in their face? Do we see the image of God and likeness of God in them? And do we treat them accordingly? And finally, creation. How does what we've heard affect how we treat creation? How we tend and care for it. Maddie, I wonder if you could just start playing the keyboard. And just, we're going to be singing a song in just a moment. But before we do that, a song which sings out great truth about who we are in Jesus, who we are in our Father God. But just think about those questions. And it could be, particularly if the issue for you is in terms of how you see yourself, you might benefit from just praying about that with somebody. There's a prayer team at the back of the room, and maybe it'd be good for you to just go and pray with someone who can affirm who you are in God. Speak out words to you of truth about who you are, how the Father sees you.